BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome back to the Short Story Podcast, where this week we're showcasing the 5 shortlisted entries in this year's BBC National Short Story Award. And we begin with a tender and beautifully crafted one by a writer who has made the shortlist for a 3rd time. In it, a woman with a young child makes a heartbreaking decision on a transatlantic flight, reflecting on the distance between where we've come from and where we end up.
All the People Were Mean and Bad, by Lucy Caldwell, read by Laura Piper. Two weeks after your cousin dies, you're on a night flight back to London from Toronto. Your daughter, at 21 months, too young for her own seat but too old really to be on your lap, is overtired and restless. All you have to entertain her while the plane taxis and waits, is the book your auntie gave her as you were leaving. It's the story of Noah's Ark, illustrated for preschoolers. All the people, it says, were mean and bad. Except for Noah. Noah was good. And because he was good, God saved him. You hate this book. Shall we look at the animals now, you say. But your daughter says no. She likes the animals, but she likes these pages even better. Over a whole double-page spread, the mean and bad people are doing mean and bad things, pulling each other's hair and laughing, aiming slingshots and catapults at each other, gurning and scowling and spitting. Your daughter makes extravagant faces and laughs with delight. Okay, let's look at the animals, you say firmly, but your daughter throws back her head and wails. I'm sorry, you say to the man sitting next to you, the man who has the misfortune to be sitting next to you for the remaining 7 hours and 36 minutes of this flight.
No problem, he says.
And he starts to say, again and unnecessarily because he's already been too kind to you, lifting your bags up into the overhead locker and fetching beakers and bunnies and the book from the stuffed chaotic tote at your feet, that he understands. Has children himself, 2 sons. But the pitch of your daughter's cry is rising. You grimace an apology at him, and he smiles back, then looks tactfully away, as if there's nothing to see at all. Please, you say to your daughter, red-faced now and howling. Please. Come on, Matilda. Shh. And you suppress the urge to shake her or start howling yourself. You take a deep breath and begin again. All the people were mean and bad. Your daughter wriggles and cries for the whole ascent. She finally falls asleep on your chest and you hold her, heavy and warm and limp and sprawling, and let your own eyes close. 7 hours and 3 minutes left. Just a little over 3,000 miles. It seems more than time and distance you're traversing. It is a lifetime ago that you left London. And it will be one of the longest stretches you and your husband have ever been apart. By far the longest he's not seen Tilly. You went with him on a couple of shoots after Tilly was born. One to Dublin, another to Cape Town. But it wasn't what either of you had thought it would be. Trying to placate a baby in unfamiliar surroundings. Endless hours wandering alone. Or lying in a hotel room trying to sleep while half waiting for him to come back. You think of times apart early on, when you, or usually he, would be away, and of meeting each other again, and how strange and shy you'd feel. You've tried, for Tilly's sake, to talk every day. Cape Town is 6 hours ahead of Toronto, so you FaceTimed each night at her bedtime, his midnight, but he was inevitably still up, either drinking with the crew or trying to resolve more problems on an already overextended shoot. You are trying not to think of it, this prolonged separation, as a separation, as a test. Anything for your wife?
the stewardess's voice says, and you open your eyes. Oh, you say, we're not, just as he says, oh, we're not, and he grins. I think, he says, she needs a gin and tonic too. And you smile and say, yes, thank you, that sounds good. Cheers, he says, the twang of his accent making it almost two syllables, like yours. And you reply with your almost two syllables, cheers. And you touch cups and sip. To sleeping babies, he says. And you say, look, I'm so sorry. And he says, I once flew solo with the twins when they just turned 3. Vancouver to Sydney with a layover in L.A. Oh boy, I wouldn't wish that journey on anyone. And he's quiet for a moment and says, my sister died an hour before we got there. And then he says, sorry. My cousin just died, you say. And I hadn't seen her in years, but for a while she was like a sister to me. I'm sorry, he says. At the same time, you say, sorry, too. Because a cousin you haven't spoken to in years is not the same as a sister. And even if there's no real metric to grief, there is, must be, a hierarchy of loss. You touch cups again, somberly this time, and sip, and finally break eye contact and look away. The blazing sunshine and high blue skies, the leaves just turning on the trees, a stupidly perfect day. The cool and calm of the mortuary chapel, old for Toronto, a fine example of Gothic Revival architecture. In the little vestibule, the tinny bluegrass of Hey Dougie from your phone, while in the nave the priest intoned and the mourners responded, standing and sitting and singing and weeping. And your cousin was no more. We are all ashes and dust eventually, you think, but now she already was. Her warm, taut body, pressed next to yours in your sleeping bag, zipped together, as she confided about a boy she'd kissed. Her long brown legs in their blue shorts, taking the stairs 2 and 3 at a time. The tattoos she tried to give you both when you were 12 and she was 14, with a spike of her compass and a cartridge of ink from your fountain pen. You think of all of this, and you think how impossible it is that all of it's gone. How the fact of its being gone makes none of it, nothing, feel true anymore. And yet, how can it all not matter? The meals trolley has made its way to you. Your tray table doesn't fold down over your daughter's sleeping body, so he takes your meal on his too, arranges both little trays lengthwise. Shall I cut it up for you? He says, and you laugh in embarrassment, as he butters your bread roll, forks up cubes of chicken, the way you might for Tilly. You don't manage more than a few bites before it all becomes too much. The bizarre intimacy of this stranger feeding you. I'm fine, you say. I'm actually not that hungry. And it's true. You haven't been for a while. The hollow feeling at your centre, the ache in your solar plexus, voids all hunger. And it feels somehow right to be at a light-headed remove from the world, as if you don't really exist or need to.
So, what do you do? He's saying, as if reading your mind. Or are you a full-time mom?
And you're saying, no, I'm an architect. Then qualifying it with, at least I used to be. Because what actually do you do now with your days, beyond endlessly pushing a buggy round the city streets, taking photographs, stone detailing or glazed brick facades, ghost signage, large Queen Anne sash windows, not even for any reason. From November, you say, when Tilly turns 2, you'll have the nursery place, 3 mornings a week to begin with. Your husband says you should take on some private resi. Leaflet the neighbours, loft conversions or extensions, something to keep you busy, get you working again. He's begun to say lately that you could set up your own practice. He nods, listening. And you find yourself talking on. Another baby would, of course, be the logical thing, and yet, every time you have the discussion, you feel deeply tired, bone weary. You used to feel a sort of delight when a word or a phrase was a perfect fit. But now, for the first time in your life, you just feel old. You stop, abruptly, expecting him to laugh at that. But he doesn't laugh. I'm 56, he says, which on a bad day rounds up to 60. And I'm 2 years divorced, and my boys are almost 24. You realize you've been trying to work out his age. I'm not, he says. I know I'm not, but in so many ways, I still feel 24 myself. I know what you mean, you say. I mean, I don't feel any different, I don't think, than I did then. I don't think we ever really do. You don't think people change, you say, or ever really can? I think people change, for sure, but only ever become essentially more themselves. You don't know if that thought is comforting or profoundly sad. Then where's the hope? If we can never truly begin again or become something else or better. He shrugs and smiles. Each moment, here, now, that's what we have. That's what we have, or that's all we have? Perhaps it's both. A girl you were at university with had married a man 25 years older. She 24, he 49. No one could understand it. You didn't know her very well, but you somehow once got drunk together, and she started crying and said the loneliest thing in the world was lying in bed with someone and wanting someone else's hands to be on you instead. They had a daughter long before any of your other uni friends had kids, who must be in her teens by now. After that drunken night, you'd stayed in touch for a while and bought a present when the baby was born. That was the only time you'd been to their house, because you felt so awkward there. They had peonies in vases and Le Creuset pans and different sized wine glasses for white or red. The house, in retrospect, wasn't that remarkable. Just a modest terraced on a street in Kentish Town. But it felt at the time like being at someone's posh English parents'. And you'd thought how strange it was that this, now, was her life. But what struck and maybe discomforted you most was how devoted she was to him. As if, after all they'd done, there wasn't the luxury of being anything else, exasperated or bickering. Although you wonder now if maybe it wasn't that at all, but rather the knowledge that they'd find each other too late in life, or in his life at least, to be reckless or casual. That the way they loved was careful and tender, not because they didn't, but because they did love each other with a sort of abandon. You have Riedel wine glasses and Dartington crystal champagne flutes yourself now, and sometimes even peonies in vases, or at least in a vase. How have you come so far from your pioneer parents, their bottle of Schlur at Christmas time or weddings, the single blue bottle of Harvey's Bristol cream they kept as a concession to your grandma? A wedding of your own, a marriage to a producer with extravagant tastes. And yet, you can't shake the sense that it has all crept up on you without your wanting or asking for it, without your feeling any different than you did at 29, 27, or, yes, 24. Can I ask you something? He says. And you say, inexplicably flustered, sure. He picks up the book, which has fallen to the floor, and opens it. Do you really believe in, well, that? That people are mean and bad and
for want of a better word, damned. I was brought up believing it all, you say. God and Noah, the flood, the ark, that the world was 6,000 years old. So that sounds like you no longer believe it. Your auntie, pale-faced, her hair drawn back to show new cheekbones, gaunt, but lit with the belief that your cousin was finally in a better place. The way the priest talked about the prescription drugs as her demons. I sometimes think that it would be easier if I still did. That's why you read it to your daughter? Oh, no, you say. No, I'm going to tactically misplace the book as soon as we get home. I guess I'd like to think, he says, that people are basically good. Neither of you says anything for a while. I'd love to be able to live like that, you say. And just for a moment, it feels like a weight is lifting. Your daughter wakes. Her ears are sore. He goes to the galley and comes back with a handful of UHT sticks, which he tears and empties one by one into her bottle. While he does this, you pace with her, joggle her up and down the cabin, and although most people are sleeping or attempting to, no one looks at you angrily. Even when Tilly sleeps again, you don't, and nor does he. You both watch the minute ticking progress of the little blue plane icon over the emptiness of the North Atlantic Ocean. You watch it and talk some more. And these are some of the things you talk about. How unfeasible it is that this great, sleek, lumbering mass of metal can rise instead of falling into the sky, up and up, can traverse the globe along invisible, predetermined tracks, corridors in the air, while its passengers sleep and watch films and request more ice for their gin and tonic. High time as a measure is, for a while, entirely meaningless. In this time, out of time, and how distance is too. And about the distances we travel, between where we come from and where we end up, between who we thought we were and who we turn out to be. About how, who knows, for your daughter there will not be transatlantic travel, at least not like this. And it may seem the most grotesque decadence of a bygone age. All of these words, these thousands of words, and none of them the right ones, the handful of words that might have meant or even changed something. And once again, only this time with even more urgency, can people change? Or is it already too late? Is it always too late? Or is there always another brief window in which anything is possible? The plane descends. The rattle and grind of the landing gears. The final roar of the engines. The headlong rush of the plane onto tarmac. The shuddering certainty of it. He carries your bags for you off the plane as you carry Tilly, still heavy with sleep. You're among the last off the plane, and the immigration hall is packed. Oh no, you say, and he rests a hand lightly on your shoulder. Hello, Heathrow, my old friend. For a moment, you stand there, in the crowd, breathing as one. Sir, madam, this way please. A uniformed woman is saying, his family's this way. And she's sliding open a barrier tape. He smiles at you, and you smile back. You pass through immigration as a family, through baggage reclaim, and pause before the sliding doors of the arrivals hall, where your husband will be meeting you and Tilly. So, I guess this is it, he says. Are you going to be okay? Yes, you say, because what else can you possibly say? And you take the handle of your suitcase from him, and you walk, not a family at all, but two entirely separate people now, through the final customs channel, nothing to declare.
Your husband isn't there. You find a power socket and plug in your phone. A series of messages. He's been delayed in Cape Town. The assistant producer couldn't handle it after all. The sequence that needs to be reshot. He's not now going to be home until tomorrow. Or maybe the next day. He's going to make it up to you. Love to Tilly. Take a cab. You knew it, you thought. Even as he was texting you as you boarded the flight in Toronto, you knew and dreaded this. Right, you say, and take the handle of your case again. Okay? Let me give you a lift, he says. There'll be a driver for me, a car. His eyes are very blue. For a moment, you almost say yes. You think of the books that you and your cousin loved, the ones with multiple pathways through and dozens of endings. You'd always be careful, trying to make it through, and she'd choose the most reckless routes possible, just to see what might happen. She would have gone with him. If she was still here, she'd say to you, "Do it." But no, you hear yourself saying. It will be easier with your daughter on the train. She's been cooped up so long. At least in a train you can walk up and down. But your bags and the buggy, he says. People are helpful, you say. They've been so helpful every bit of the way. And it's true, you realise in a rush, thinking of the taxi driver who found you a trolley, wheeled your bags into the terminal. Of Chantal, who upgraded you to premium economy for free. Her long nails, midnight blue with crystals, tapping. And how, in an attempt to give her something back, you'd said how you admired them, and how she'd beamed. Of the people around you, who didn't roll their eyes or glare at you as Tilly howled. And him, of course. And him. And suddenly, you find yourself on the verge of all the tears you haven't yet cried. "Oh," he says, "come here." And he takes your face in both his hands and brushes away the tears with his thumbs. And then there's a moment and everything tilts. There is an artist whose work you once saw in a Whitechapel gallery. She had stitched to a globe of the world metallic threads representing one single day's flights, then somehow dissolved the globe, leaving just the sugar-spun mass of threads. And you think of it now, how fine the threads that connect us from one person or place to another, and how precious, and how strong. "I have to go," you say, "because if you stay for a moment longer, you won't. Or won't be able to." "What are you going to do now?" he says. "Now this minute now, or now in a more existential sense," you say, and somehow you manage to say it lightly. He looks at you, then takes up your cue. "Somewhere between the two. We're going to watch Hey Dougie on the train. We're going to press all the buttons in the lift. Maybe bake a cake. Which will really be a pretext for cracking lots of eggs and bashing the shells up with a teaspoon." He laughs. You realise you love that laugh. You love that you've made him laugh. "Okay then," he says softly. And you hear or maybe feel him take a breath and let it slowly out. "Okay," he says. "Goodbye." "Goodbye," you say. You do let Tilly press all of the buttons in the lift, all 7 of them. You don't sigh when the slow doors judder open and closed. You just feel numb. You do bake the cake. You let Tilly crack the whole carton of eggs, and you tell her the joke about Hamlet and egos that your cousin had to explain to you. And you turn away before she can see that your laughter, at how clever you thought it is turning to sobs. You could email him, you think. You could Google his name, his company. You won't, but you could. You call up a Google tab on your phone. You won't. You don't. You look at a map of Canada on your phone instead. It's so vast. There's just so much space. The whole sweep of it. So empty, so much that you have to hold on to the balustrade to steady yourself, on the verge of doubling over with a sort of homesickness. This sudden intensity of loss. Breathe, you tell yourself. Just breathe. Your husband is only doing his best. He's been so worried, since Tilly was born, about providing for you, about the precariousness of his industry, about what it means to be a family. He's doing his best. And you think that you must do your best too, to still love him. And you think that love gone wrong or astray is also a kind of exile. It was right, you tell yourself, not to accept the lift. It would have been a line crossed. And yet, you wonder, can't help yourself wondering what it would have been like had you gone with him, back to his hotel maybe, where he holds you in his arms, kneels before you and presses his face to you, eases your jeans from your hips. And maybe that's what you want, for someone to undress you and lay you down to make the decisions for you. But however you try to stage the sequence in your head, you can't get past the fact of your daughter there, and the whole thing dissipates. You try to keep Tilly up until her bedtime, but she's far too tired, and so you give in mid-afternoon. She wants the book, but you barely begin it before she's fallen asleep. You lie there for a while, gazing at the cartoon people with their ugly, gargoyle faces. All the people were mean and bad, except that what he said is right. They weren't. They couldn't be. That isn't the way you want to live this life or whatever of it remains to you. They were only doing their best, you think, or the best that they thought they could. And unlike stern, righteous, virtuous Noah, no one ever told them they were going to die or be saved or that any of it, in the end, ever mattered.
Laura Piper was reading All the People Were Mean and Bad by Lucy Caldwell. It was produced by Justine Willett. Here's an interview with writer Lucy Caldwell from BBC Radio 4's Front Row. She began by telling Tom Sutcliffe why she chose to write her story in the second person.
There's a theme running through this story of the choose your own adventure books that my character and I loved as a child. They're the sort of books where at the end of every page there's a choice. You know, do you go out into the forest to investigate the strange, eerie noise, or do you stay in your cabin? And with those books, you're constantly having to make decisions. What do you do next? What do you do now? And that's the soundtrack, really, for my character. She doesn't know what to do. She wants someone to tell her what to do. She wants someone to make the decision for her. But the second person that it's written in, it's not that sort of role play second person. The reader isn't required to play a role in the story. It's a way of writing that four of the stories in my first collection, Multitudes, and another four in Intimacies, where this story comes from, are in the second person because first person comes quite naturally to me as a playwright, I suppose, ventriloquizing, channeling the characters. But sometimes a character might not have enough self-awareness to talk about themselves. Or if they told the story in the past tense, it would already be over. There'd be that sense that they were recounting something resolved. But the second person, the way that I use it here, I wanted the reader to be almost at the narrator's shoulder, hardly able to breathe, listening to this intensely important dialogue between the voice in her head and herself as she tries to figure out what to do.
It's an unusual voice for a reader, isn't it? Because the first moment you encounter it, you think, Well, no, I'm not a young mother with a child. There is this moment of tension where you resist the voice of the story. And then, of course, the story takes over and you succumb to it. And do you think you get a greater identification there, or are you held at some reserve in the way that you are with a third person narration where the story is saying he did this or she did this next?
Well, you can tell me. As a reader, I quite often bristle at that being told what I am and where I am.
So you bristle, but you're happy to use it as a writer.
But I think if it's done successfully, one of the shortlistees for last year's BBC NSSA Award, Caleb Azuma-Nelson, his debut novel Open Water uses a second person, and he uses it to explore what it means to be a young black man in the city. And his use of it opens up to such a gorgeous tenderness, you know, such a closeness. And it was a tenderness, a closeness, an intimacy. That's what I was going for. Some of my favourite stories in the second person that I loved in my early 20s, Laurie Moore, How to Be Another Woman, from her collection Self-Help.
Well, How to Be a Writer, isn't it?
How to Be a Writer. There's another one. There's, yeah. There's 10. Yeah. Sorry. David Foster Wallace, in the middle of the really tough and nasty Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, has this gorgeous story called Forever Overhead that's told in the second person. The character's 13. Today is your 13th birthday. And I think it can get if a character it can't quite articulate something, but it can open up a real closeness once you get into the rhythms of it.
Does it take you a long time to find the voice for a story? And is that a process that always has to happen before you can write? You have to find the particular way in which that person is going to speak.
Yes, this story, a few places that I always think that a story comes to life when, you know, you have this great pile of tinder and there's a spark. One of the things I'd been thinking about for a long time was choose your own adventure stories. Another thing was my daughter was very young at the time and I was taking her to a stay and play run by a church, a local church, and they had these illustrated Bible stories for young children. The Noah's Ark story and my story is a fictionalised version of one of those. And I was thinking about how children encounter those big narratives, you know, about how we live our lives. And I was thinking about how Noah's Ark is very familiar and seems very cosy, but actually it's pretty terrifying. You know, the idea of a mean and vengeful and capricious and petulant God who just decides to wipe everything out, you know, one fell swoop. And so I was playing with that. The story had that tension in it, but it wasn't until I got the tone of it in form. It's an elegy, really. The narrator is mourning her cousin. She's an only child. They were very, very close as children. And she was, so the tone of it is an elegy.
It's set in this unusual space too. I mean, you know, what you would formally call a liminal space. It's between places. It's between Toronto. She's in the air on this long haul flight. And in this odd cabined intimacy of a long haul flight where you suddenly find yourselves very close to strangers. And in, you describe it very well as this time out of time. Why did that particularly work on your imagination as a setting for it?
Well, this story has a very tight framework, and the framework for the story is this long haul flight. So the story takes place, we're in the cabin at takeoff, and then we take her through the flight, through the night, back home to her flat in London. And the conversation that she has, there's a strange sort of freedom, I think, to being outside of your usual time, outside of your usual place, in a time that doesn't really exist because time is doing all sorts of strange things on a transatlantic flight. You know, what time zone are you in? And maybe it's possible for her to step outside of herself, step outside of her life, question the choices that she's made, question the things she's done without even realising that a choice was being made.
It's an odd... people often report that they are far more emotionally moved by movies on planes. I think you are. You open up in a strange way, don't you? In that suspended place.
And you do. You eat bread that's been specifically engineered to taste good at 30,000 feet. I find that extraordinary.
It is a story about a marriage, this. I mean, the cliche has it that absence makes the heart grow fonder. It's much more complicated than that, isn't it? It seems to me the story is very good about the strange business of leaving your partner or leaving a husband or a wife and having this space away from them, which can often usher in all sorts of thoughts.
Yeah, the story is called All the People Are Mean and Bad, but every single person in the story is kind, from the taxi driver who helps to open the boot of his taxi and fit in the buggy, to the man that the narrator is sitting beside who helps tear endless sachets of milk into a baby's bottle, to the passengers who don't roll their eyes pointedly when a baby is crying all night long. Every single person is kind. And the narrator, her husband, is work. There's nothing bad has happened, and yet she senses this distance between them. And she grew up very religious. She grew up with a very strict moral code. She grew up in a sort of fundamentalist religious household. But she's questioning now, what does it mean to be a good person? What does it mean to be a bad person? What does it mean to be saved? What does it mean to be damned?
I absolutely loved the line in the story, "Your husband is only doing his best." I think it's a very interesting construction, that it has a shimmer of ambiguity to it, because you start reading it, the only suggests that he's not doing quite enough. And then you get to the best and realise, well, that's all he's got. There isn't anything more than he can do than that. And that might be the tragedy of this marriage, or it might be the saving of it. It seems a little up in the air when I finish the story as to which of those is the case.
That's right. And I think the conclusion of the story, the narrator is hoping, she just desperately wants someone to tell her what to do. Someone, you know, a patriarchal figure, a Noah, a God, to tell her. And the story's conclusion really is that that isn't going to happen. But all we have is here and now and each other and being as kind as possible. And everyone is trying their best.
You do. You echo that line, don't you, at the very end of the thing. You were a judge last year. What did that make you feel about the process? I know this story was written, as it were, well before. I think it was written before you were a judge.
Yes, it was. In fact, it was due to be published while I was judging the competition. But this book, Intimacies, it was just about to come out when the pandemic struck, and my publishers delayed it for a whole year. And so I judged the award, and, you know, you get hundreds of stories, and the rigour, the conversations that you have, the debates you have, you know, it goes on for hours. It's a really, really rigorous process. The stories are judged anonymously. And this year I hadn't actually entered a story. I'd been a judge, you know, I'd been shortlisted before. And my editor asked a day or so before the deadline, had I entered? And I said I hadn't. I hadn't written any eligible stories. And he said, well, I'd love to enter this one. It's technically eligible because publication
because
was delayed.
Because of the pandemic. It's an ill wind. So did you feel a little self-conscious about it once you knew it was through?
I felt a bit self-conscious, but, you know, I'm just so grateful to the award. The shortlisting for my first story gave me such a boost, and it's wonderful to be here again.
Thanks for listening. The winner of the BBC National Short Story Award will be announced on the 19th of October. And you can hear the next shortlisted entry tomorrow right here on the BBC Short Story Podcast.